Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. And today's show draws from a talk given by Charles Eisenstein, author of The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. He was accompanied by musician Trevor Oswald of East Forest, and the talk took place this month at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland and was sponsored by Portland City Repair Project and the Economic Justice Action Group.
Trevor talked about me being the guy who walks the walk. I don't really identify myself that way. To the extent that I walk the walk, it's because of the support that I get. It's because of, 300 people showing up and implying that I'm not delusional. It's because I put stuff out there and people resonate with it, and that kind of uplifts me. And I think that this is not modesty, okay? It's just reality. It's recognizing how a human being works, that we're not separate beings in a world of other, and that even if we're talking about spiritual enlightenment or consciousness, it's not something that you do yourself and that you succeed at or fail at through your own hard efforts. If you think that your more developed consciousness is because of something you did, then essentially you're saying, I'm better than you, I'm better than somebody else, and we are fundamentally separate. And you could even say, then that's a delusion, and so you might say that, yes, it's true that some people are more evolved than others, and the way you can tell if someone's more evolved or not is that if they think that they are, then they're not. Anyway, little paradox to start with. So as far as walking the walk goes, I think actually we're all in the same boat. I want to tell you a story. I hesitate to use the man's name because he's very well known and he hasn't given me permission to use his name in the story, although I think it would be okay, but I'm going to anonymize it slightly. He's a well-known person who wrote a book that is very critical of the financial industry and the way that things work. And he was going to write the book many, many years before. And so he kind of talked to his colleagues, and people in the government and in the CIA and people that he knew, and was saying, yeah, I'm going to write this book. What do you think, And so he started writing it. And then he started getting death threats. And threats against his children, who were young at the time. And he was feeling pretty scared because the people who were giving him death threats are people who actually kill people sometimes. Like, this was serious stuff. And at the same time, he also got a new job offer. And they said, let's call him Bob. They said, Bob, we would like to pay you $500,000 a year. Your job description is to have your name on our letterhead. And by the way, you can't write that book. And he told me, he said, I'm not proud of it, but I took the bribe. And I spent 10 years, founding organizations and doing nonprofit work and exploring sacred plants and things like that. And then when I wrote the book, I did it kind of by surprise so that it was a public thing. And he made some other changes. But the point is that I think we're all kind of in the same boat. I'm going to have to get his permission to tell the story because it's more powerful with more details. But we're all kind of faced with the carrot and the stick, not in such a dramatic way, but we face these decision points where one path seems to be, it's the bribe, it's the carrot. It's the path that seems to give us financial security, status, and the approval of the authority figures in our lives, which could be family members, it could be just society in general. That's the carrot path. And then there's the other choice that feels like it's it feels like a leap of faith. It feels scary. It feels like, am I going to be okay if I do this? Is my family going to be okay? Am I going to make money? Am I going to have financial security? Am I going to be seen as doing a worthy thing in the world? Am I going to be called crazy? Am I going to be called impractical, naive, delusional? We face this choice point. And why is it that the choice that seems, I'm generalizing here, but the choice that seems most in service to society, to the planet, to life on Earth, to the things that make our hearts sing, why is that the one that is systemically discouraged? And why is the one that is just kind of part of greasing the wheels of the machine and continuing the status quo, why is that the one that we're encouraged to take? Why is it set up that way? And so we feel kind of alienated by the system or whatever, the establishment, by the machine, by the universe even. Why are we cast into this situation? So I guess this is a long way of saying that in various ways we're all walking the walk. Like, you can't blame this friend of mine for taking the bribe when they're mailing him blow-up photos of his children getting off the school bus. You know, like, I mean, it takes a brave man to do something even if your life is threatened, but if your children's life is threatened, that's a whole other universe, you know? Like, we can't blame him. In fact, the whole mentality of blame gets back again to that delusion of the separate self, that if I were you, I would do better than that because I'm different from you. So the fundamental core of everything that is happening here, it all comes from a revolution in our understanding of what it is to exist, what it is to be, what a self is. And the revolution is a transition from the separate self, the individual, the Cartesian consciousness in a prison made of flesh, the bubble of psychology, the economic man, the genetically programmed reproductive self-interest maximizing machine, transition from that to a interconnected, interdependent, interexistent self. That's underneath all of this. It's a change in our understanding of self, our experience of self, and our story of self. The story that tells us who we are, why we're here, how the world works, what's normal, and what's real. Therefore, the core of activism or true radicalism, however it's expressed in our lives, for some of you it might have a political expression. For some of you it might be very close to home. On the community level, some of you might be doing things that don't look like activism at all because they're totally invisible. They're happening inside of a family. They're happening inside of a home. They're happening in loneliness. They're happening, maybe you are ministering to an elderly person, to your grandmother, to your mother, doing the kind of thankless work that nobody's going to say is saving the world. Nobody's going to say is changing the system. But that you know, on some level, that is the most important thing you could possibly be doing right now. You know, I have, like, again, speaking of walking the walk here, I have this slight advantage, which is that I'm doing things that the old story says, at least could say, are valid, because at least I'm out there with a big audience, reaching tens of thousands of people, doing a thing that has a measurable impact, while maybe you're taking care of a child, you're taking care of a sick person. So what you're doing is less important. But on some level, we know that logic is the problem. That whole way of making choices in life. We were given a formula for choice making in school I remember this actually happened. The teacher said, okay, you write choice A, choice B, you add up the pros and the cons, whichever has the biggest number, that's the one you do. Well, that seems absurd. I mean, imagine applying that to love, you know? But that is essentially the cost-benefit analysis. And that's what economists tell us. They say, this is how you make decisions. Human beings seek to maximize rational self-interest. And biologists say the same about reproductive self-interest. So the indoctrination is really strong about how that's how you should approach life. And to do it any other way seems irrational. And in a way, it is irrational. But look where rationality has gotten us as a civilization. And I'll add one more thing, which is that the kind of work that this metric-based impact, measurable impact-based approach to decision-making validates is the kind of work that men have done more of, and the kind of work that it invalidates is the kind of work that women have done more of. Just a little aside there, you know, in case you care. So that's why some people look at the transition ahead of us as a transition into a more feminine world, which doesn't mean that the women take over and occupy the positions that the men once occupied and have equal opportunity to control the world-destroying machine. It's a much deeper revolution than that.
Charles Eisenstein speaking on The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible with music of East Forest. You're tuned to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland.
So today I was looking at some city repair stuff. You know, maybe some of you don't even know about city repair too much. I know some of you are from out of town, but the idea basically is, you know, we can't all run away to an eco-village. I mean, we know maybe what a city could and should be, but it's so far from where we are right now. We can't just build new cities from scratch that are high density and interlinked by bike paths and, you know, the hippie planet vision. Like, we can't just say, well, it's so far away, so, you know, we might as well just do nothing. Like, city repair is like, yeah, we can repair the cities that are so dysfunctional and broken. In whatever way we can. So one of the things they do is they paint intersections with like murals and things, and they put up like pop-up tea houses. And I was at one of those intersections today in a neighborhood, in Mark's neighborhood actually, where the fences have come down, where there's fruit trees everywhere, and like a lawn is the exception. Like if you have like a nicely manicured lawn, your neighbors will think that you're weird. You know, like, you know, if you don't have like tomato vines and like, yeah. So, I felt really moved by it. I felt like, yeah, this is right. There's something really right and beautiful about this. I felt inspired too, not only by the what people are doing in their separate property, but by the breakdown in the sense of my property, your property, the city's property. Like, this is, as Mark says, you know, we don't own the land. The land owns us. We are of the land. And so they're beginning to live into that in concrete ways. So it's very inspiring to me. Now there's a cynical kind of political part of my brain that said, oh, but so what? You know, this is not really changing the political system. It's just this little privileged enclave, and besides, how is that gonna matter in the face of climate change? How is that gonna matter when the unstoppable forces of economic development eviscerate this city and convert it into gentrifying neighborhoods? How's this going to stop neoliberal capitalism? You know, what about, you know, nuclear power plants? What about this? What about, I mean, there's so many huge problems that it's just like another version of the same voice that says, yeah, you know, your time spent taking care of one child, one sick person, one old person, or almost anything that people are involved in this room. Like, what if your passion is to end Navy testing of sonar that is deafening whales, and you spend all your energy on that? What if it's about freeing a wrongly convicted prisoner from death row? You know, stopping one road or one dam somewhere. There's so many little pieces that on their own are, it's kind of naive to work for those things. So we have this relatively new narrative that seeks to justify and connect all of these things, and it's called climate change. So it says, city repair, that's good, because it's reducing the carbon footprint of the people who live in that way. That's good. And restoring wetlands, that's good because of their carbon sequestration potential. Freeing prisoners from death row, I'm sorry. You know, not really gonna make much difference. They're gonna be dead anyway when the sea levels rise 50 feet. And housing the houseless, that's a big thing here in Portland, you know? Well, actually, that's probably gonna make climate change worse, because these houseless people are living a very low carbon lifestyle. And once they're in houses, you know, and they're able to get jobs and things like that, they're gonna be joining the production and consumption world. So you're making things worse. It's like Ebenezer Scrooge, you know? Send them to the workhouses, you know, don't feed them because there's a population problem, right? So this, I'm writing a book on this about one of the main themes is what I call carbon reductionism. And like, yeah, city repair is reducing the carbon footprint, but to say that's what validates it and makes it worthy, it takes the heart out of it. Like, that's not why I thought it was so beautiful. What happens, and so I think the danger is that here we have a new metric, a new abstract standard. It's not money anymore, but it's CO2, by which to evaluate the worthiness of our choices and implicitly then to make decisions on that basis. And I'm thinking, yeah, what does that devalue? What does that ignore? What is left invisible by those metrics? So I did this thought experiment. What would happen if we completely discarded carbon and only made our decisions as a society based on what is healing and beautiful toward local ecosystems? Well, no more fracking, because that pollutes and insults the water. No more mountaintop removal, because that defiles the mountains. No more oil drilling, because oil spills devastate, which are inevitable, devastate marine life. Like, actually, all the things that we have to do to cut CO2, we would do for those other reasons. And a lot of things that don't make sense in the CO2 reductionist paradigm that get ignored, we would also do, because, like the things I just mentioned. But I want to return now to this, a question I was talking to Mark about earlier. Like, everybody here in this room, to some extent, is unified by something that we can feel, but we're not quite sure usually what it is. Like, what is it that unites? I mean, we can feel the alliance. We can feel, even if your passion is, say, racial justice, and someone else's passion is stopping a pipeline, and someone else wants to free an orca from captivity, and for someone else, it's to get composting toilets legal. Maybe they are legal here already, but they aren't in a lot of places. And maybe someone else is passionate about teaching yoga or empowering people to take care of their own health. Like attachment parenting might be another example. Like we're all kind of gravitating toward the same things. Like the attachment parenting person, like I feel like, yeah, we're working on the same thing. And you might have that feeling, I'm trying to free an orca and you're practicing attachment parenting and we're working on the same thing. What is that thing that we're all working on? What is this alliance? Why are we all in this room together? And this also answers my cynic's question, my cynic's denunciation of these, of city repair and all of these small things. Because what we're all working on is the, I said it before, the transformation of the defining story that we live in, which is the story of separation. And its replacement by a story of, using Thich Nhat Hanh's word, interbeing, that says we're not separate selves in a world of other. We are interconnected. We are reflections of everything else that is. We are, well, I think everyone knows what it is, but it's the feeling you get when you look at somebody else and you have that realization, oh, this is the same being as me, looking from different eyes. Or when something comes up in a relationship and you realize some difficulty in the, that you encounter and you see how that is a mirror of something that's inside of you, that the inner and the outer mirror each other. It's the understanding that anything that happens in one place is, even if it seems invisible, is significant. Everything that you do is significant. Even if you cannot map out through your received understanding of cause and effect how it will make a difference, somehow you know that it will make a difference. I'd like to invoke Rupert Sheldrake's theory of morphic resonance to explain that, which is the theory that a change that happens one place creates a field of change that allows the same change to happen more easily somewhere else as a universal law. So in the case of city repair, the mind of separation says, okay, what you're doing in Portland, that could make a difference other places, it could change the world, but only if it somehow scales up or goes viral. Therefore, our biggest, if we just do it here locally, not that important, not good enough. We have to make sure that it spreads. And that's the top priority. Because if it's just local, then it wasn't worth anything. And that's not to say that it might not somehow spread in some mundanely understandable way. But that's not a condition. Its value is not conditioned upon that. And the same thing about city repair. If you trust the new story, the new and ancient story of interbeing, if you accept the reality of morphic resonance, then you know that your job is to do it well, right here. Whatever you're doing, whether your call is to operate on a personal level, family level, community level, place level, or it could be a national level, it could be a global level, whatever calls you, you have the confidence that my job is to respond to that call and to devote my gifts toward the need that the world is presenting to myself. And that is my job. Maybe it will scale up, maybe it will go viral, maybe its effect on the future will happen through more mysterious pathways that you cannot possibly know in advance.
You're listening to Charles Eisenstein speaking on The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, accompanied by the music of East Forest. You're tuned to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland.
Think about something that disrupted the story for you. And one thing that story disruption does is it It changes your understanding of what's possible. I guess here's the carrot and the stick again. There's a push and a pull. The push is the breakdown of the old story. It does not working anymore. The pull is when you get a glimpse of what's possible, something that is from the next world. Like I had visiting the block, the city repair block, you know, like there's a pull toward that. Or it could be in a totally different realm. Like maybe you went through the medical initiation where you got sick and the doctor couldn't fix you. And you went to a specialist and he couldn't fix you either. And you went to another one and that one said, the tests show nothing. Here's some Prozac. That'll make you feel better. And you finally went to one and said, oh, actually you do have some autoimmune condition and we can't really do much about it. And the story fell apart and you were in the space between stories until you encountered, I don't know, a naturopath or an acupuncturist who did something to you that has supposedly no scientific validity and took you off gluten, et cetera, and you got better. And showing you, basically saying the reality, and I'm just making up an example here, but it happens to be my wife's example, but, you know. you know, something happens in your life that shows you that reality isn't what you thought it was. That life could be different than you'd been told. That possibility is larger than you had known. This is actually an important research project to share stories of what caused you to change your reality, what caused you to change your story, your beliefs. Because if we're going to have a livable planet in a generation from now, a lot of beliefs are going to have to change. And beliefs aren't just opinions in our heads. People often profess an opinion that's the opposite of their true belief. For example, they may profess the opinion that God is watching them all the time. But if they actually believed it, they would behave in a very different way. They may profess an opinion that we're all interconnected, but they may act selfishly. Sometimes. Using myself as an example here. So the question then is, what really changes our beliefs? If we are mistaken about what changes beliefs, then nothing will change. If we expend our activist energy on a theory of change and a strategy of change that doesn't work, then we're wasting our time. I'd like to just talk about a theory of change and what that is. The old story, the story of separation, has a theory of change. It says you exert a force on a mass and movement happens. The bigger the force, the bigger the change. This is Newtonian mechanics. Therefore, if you want to make a big change in the world, you better have a lot of force. Hierarchical power, military force, money to make people do things, or a big platform. So if you're doing something important, then you have to get these resources to have a big effect. And in the end, you get many, many, many NGOs and environmental organizations all competing with each other for mailing lists and for funding and things like that. That's the theory of change. Force. On the intellectual level, the theory says if you want to change somebody's beliefs, you must present them with superior logic and evidence that will force them to change their beliefs. And gosh, why are all those Trump supporters not changing their beliefs? Well, they must be incapable of sound logic, and they must be blind to correct evidence. That's why. Right? In that theory of change, that could be the only explanation, because we are so right and they're so wrong. If they would only see the evidence, if they would only listen to logic, then they would change. That is the mantra of 95% of all political activists, left, right, and center. If they would only see the evidence, if they would only listen to logic, then they would change their beliefs. We're right and they're wrong. Well, what if people don't change their beliefs that way? Guess what? They don't. There are actually academic studies that show this. They take a bunch of people, they give them a questionnaire, they find out what their beliefs are, then they present them with evidence that contradicts their beliefs blatantly. Then they give them another questionnaire, and they discover that after having been confronted with contradictory evidence, they become more convinced of their beliefs. Haven't you had this experience at Thanksgiving? Well, but maybe that's just uneducated people. Close-minded bigots, not open-minded, educated people like you, right? Well, actually, in these studies, the more highly educated the person is, the less likely they are to change their beliefs. So if beliefs don't change that way, how do they change? They change through an experience that doesn't fit into the story. Stories, however, like all beings, have an immune system. They have a way of maintaining their integrity. So if your story is strong, it will keep out contradictory evidence. For example, how controversial do I want to go here? Like, how many of you should I alienate here? I recently heard a talk by a flat earth advocate. It was fascinating, actually. He gave all this evidence that contradicted the spherical earth theory. I don't believe in the flat earth, okay? Just let me say that to begin with. But like, it was a pretty persuasive talk. Like, some of the stuff, I'm like, hold on. Like, actually, what about, diffraction of light rays? Couldn't that explain it? Like, other stuff I had no idea how to refute his argument. And I'm pretty well scientifically educated, Did I change my beliefs then because of his persuasive, that overcame? No, actually, I went back and looked at people who debunked that theory, and like, oh yeah, there's the explanation, right? I actually became stronger in my belief in a spherical Earth. But what was fascinating, was the response of the audience. Like, a lot of people were nodding, and like having this revelation. And what it said to me is that faith in the institution of science is wearing thin, which is a primary form of authority in our culture. It tells us what reality is. It's our priesthood. That speaks in its arcane language and gives the answers to the laity. And they've been telling us a lot of stuff that has turned out not to be true, especially in medical science, but also with like GMOs, and nuclear power and all these other things that DDT, you can eat it by the spoonful, it was said by scientists. Anyway. So we can offer people an experience that doesn't fit into the story. And because the foundational story is the story of separation, anything that you do that doesn't fit into the story of separation will disrupt that story, which means any act of kindness or generosity, compassion, love, doesn't fit into the story of separation and is therefore a political act. So I want to expand our conception of what is political to include all of those things that have been invalidated by that cynical political voice, which isn't to say, oh, don't do the political stuff and just retreat into the private realm of relationship, but it's to equally validate all of those and not privilege one over the other. And sometimes you can see, there's the archetype of the activist, the environmental activist who neglects family and is a jerk in his organization, but it's all for the cause. It's all for an important cause. And you think, well, what's going to happen if that person takes over? We're going to get a different version of the same thing. Okay. Anyway, I would like to then ask you to have a conversation with someone next to you or behind you. And share a short story about something that pushed you out of your old story, a breakdown. Could be like a big dramatic breakdown, or it could be a little vignette that was part of the process of breakdown. Like maybe it could be a tiny moment of injustice. Like when my friend back, our neighbor in State College, Pennsylvania, where I used to live, he was a musician, and he was leaving a gig, and he saw a man get punched by a gang of four fraternity men and knocked out. And this man was like knocked out and lying on the street. And then a cop came up and arrested the man. And my neighbor said, "Hey, that guy just got assaulted. You know, you shouldn't arrest him." And the cop's like, "You tell me how to do my job?" And that, like, my neighbor had a story about the police and who they are and what their role is. And that maybe didn't disintegrate that story, but it damaged that story. You know, it was part of a transition process. You might have an anti-gay Republican, and then all of a sudden his son comes out to him, you know, and this happened to one of my friends, and man, like, you could have argued, given him evidence, made all the arguments, and nothing would have changed, but that. This happened to me, actually, similar story. When I was 20 years old, and I was traveling around the country, and was arrested going into my senior year at Yale University. I was arrested and put in jail for 2 days for possession of marijuana. And it was a family disgrace. My mother cried when I told her, first person in our highly educated family to go to jail. And up until then, I believed that people in jail were bad people. You know, they did something wrong, and they probably deserved to be in jail, you know, with maybe a few unfortunate exceptions, but, you know, that's where the bad people were. Like, I just kind of naively just bought into that as if it were reality itself and not a belief. But when I was in jail, like, I met really interesting people. And the men there, they had children. They wanted to show me the pictures of their children. They were acting just like people do outside of jail, more or less. And I realized that they were almost kind of there by accident, you know, like in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they have their problems, and they were humorous. They were good. They had goodwill for us. They, you know, knew instantly what we were. You know, a couple of rich white hippie kids. You know. They were all white, too. This was Idaho. But, you know, very different social class. I'm like, boy, that just shattered my story. I never saw the world the same after that. Maybe you have a story like that, that eroded or disrupted reality. And again, relationship reality, medical reality, educational reality, parenting reality, social reality, political reality, civic reality, any of these things. Could be a city repair story. Buddy, what have you seen that told you I was living in too small a story? And maybe when it happened, a secret part of you said, "I knew it, but I didn't dare believe it. And maybe I still don't dare believe it. Because I was born with this knowledge. I was born with the knowledge that a more beautiful world is possible. And it was betrayed."
This is Charles Eisenstein with musician East Forest in a presentation, "The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible." You're tuned to The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland.
the deep problem is that we have a financial system and a money creation system that only works in the context of growth, of economic growth. And whether it's public banking or private banking, that's still true as long as money is created as interest-bearing debt, which means that there's always more money than there's always more debt than there is money, which means that we have to have a constant increase in the amount of goods and services in order to keep, this is going to get complicated, to keep new money being created to keep pace with the growth of debt. So, and this, you see this in public policy, it's taken for granted that you have to have economic growth. And that's not just an ideological delusion. That is an inescapable consequence of the kind of money system that we have. It stops working if you don't have economic growth. What is growth? Growth means the conversion of nature into products and the conversion of human relationships into services. It's inescapable. So it's consistent with the story of separation that I talked about before, where humanity becomes the lords and masters of nature. The story of humanity separate from nature, turning more and more of nature into property. So you can see how deeply, you know, our money system isn't just like some dumb idea that, you know, Dutch bankers came up with in the 17th century. It's completely aligned and integrated with our deep mythology, and will only change in tandem with the changing of our deep mythology. What does this mean in practice? On a local level, you know, if you're not into like this kind of nerdy stuff, you know, on a local level, it means reversing the movement toward monetization. It means reclaiming some of life from money. It means reclaiming some of relationship from money. It means no longer outsourcing the things that we need to thrive, such as childcare, cooking, healing, entertainment. I mean, these are some of the things that City Repair is reclaiming too. Let's make our own entertainment. Let's have our children all play with each other and not ship them off to daycare, you know? Let's reclaim some of life. Let's no longer buy everything we need because we can share it in tool libraries. We can have public space so that we don't have to enclose more and more of what was the commons into private dwellings. When public space disappears, when there's nothing to do outside, then you have to have a bigger house because you need more room to live your life. But if you have a thriving public space, you don't want to be inside that much because that's not where the action is. So reclaiming public space is very disruptive to our economic system because it is anti-growth. It's a degrowth. It's a degrowth movement. It's reclaiming anything you do to reclaim life from money hurts the economy. If you have a tool library, then not every house on the block has to buy their own set of power tools anymore. Well, that's bad for the power tool companies and bad for the people who work in those companies. So it basically intensifies and accelerates the financial crisis, but it also creates a reservoir of resiliency and community to help us weather that crisis. It creates a kind of wealth that a financial crisis can't touch. So reskilling, ways of sharing, taking care of each other, watching out for each other, anything that disengages us from the growth of goods and services hastens the crisis and mitigates it at the same time. The entire world that we are accustomed to, the world of financial capital, the world of ecocide, the world of racism and dehumanization, all of that is the outgrowth of a mythology. The mythology of separation. For the separate self in the world of other, well-being comes through controlling and dominating the other, through overcoming the forces of nature. Part of the story says that only human beings have full selfhood. Maybe animals have a little bit, plants a rudimentary amount, and the world at large, clouds, water, air, wind, the west, the east, the north, the south, the sun, the moon, these are random assemblies of molecules bouncing around, driven by forces that are arbitrary or random. They don't have selfhood. The events of our lives don't have intelligence. The world outside of ourselves doesn't have intelligence. Therefore, it is the prerogative of human beings to impose design and impose intelligence on a world that is mute and bereft of agency and intelligence. That's human destiny, and look how far we've come from being helpless, struggling to survive, superstitious animals, to now understanding the world, being able to manipulate it, being able to impose intelligence on it. And in the future, this control will be someday completed with nanotechnology and genetic engineering, and we'll be able to make a perfect world, finally. Like, that's the mythology that we've lived in. And you can see all of our institutions, from medicine, education, politics, you know, US foreign policy, all about control, all about imposing onto the other, which is lesser than the self. You can look at the money system that way. I mean, I wrote a whole book on that, you know. The educational system, everything. The penal system, you know, the criminal punishment system. Agriculture, you know, it's all a war on the other. And that is what we're transcending. That's what we are graduating from out of that story. And all of the institutions built on that story, which isn't working anymore, which is falling apart collectively and in our personal lives as well, many of us, because these collective stories have an internal projection. The war on the other, on nature, is reflected as a war on the self, where well-being comes through dominating the parts of yourself that are bad. It comes through a tremendous effort of will at self-conquest. This is all becoming obsolete. And as we transition out of that story, we feel alienated by the institutions of that story. We don't want to participate in them. But there are not yet new institutions to welcome us. There are not yet new institutions that say, yes, your desire to heal the wetlands, your desire to restore the rivers so that the salmon can swim up them again, those are right. Those are worthy. And we will pay you to do that. No, the money is still in cutting down the forests and building the housing developments and paving things over. So the systems are not aligned with the consciousness that we're moving into, and they pull us back, the money system in particular, but also the internalized system, where we look to for validation and approval. So we're living in this transition time between stories, a space between stories. Maybe we're starting to be able to conceptualize the new story, but we don't have its institutions yet. But we're trying to build them without a playbook, without a recipe. We get little bits, and that's what City Repair is doing, by the way, trying to build social forms that resonate with the change in consciousness that's pulling all of us. But we don't know how to do it. Maybe we can conceptualize the answers a little bit, but we're not familiar with them. They haven't inhabited us deeply. And that's why we need each other in gatherings like this. As we wander the space between stories. The old story told us how to be a human being, how to live a life, how it began, how it proceeded, how it was supposed to end, what its structures look like, how to do it. You go to school, you study hard, you get good grades, you get a good job, you start saving for retirement, you make prudent decisions, you get married, you live in a little box with your little family. And when you get sick, the doctor will fix you. Like, we had this whole story. And it's breaking down. The story of marriage is breaking down. The story of the doctor can fix you is breaking down. The story of study hard and you will have a rewarding, satisfying position in society is breaking down. Instead, you graduate with debt and no job. You know, it's all breaking down. And we get ejected from that story on a personal level in different ways. Something similar is happening on a collective level. The old story about what society should look like, how to manage this thing, it's breaking down. And we're in this, many of us are entering this bewildered stage, which is absolutely necessary. Because you can't, there's no room for a new story to come in while the old one is still intact. Just as, and this is just my opinion, obviously, but you know, everything that we call alternative today, I mean, even here in Portland, I'm from Asheville, North Carolina now, it's the same there, you know, like there's so much alternative culture, but it's still alternative culture. And what's dominant, you know, in Asheville, there's probably 20 or 30 organic restaurants, but there are several hundred Bojangles and KFCs and McDonald's and all those, right? I mean, there's lots of people on bikes, but the number of trips per car here in Portland is many, many, many times greater. I mean, the old story is still dominant, but it's hollowing out from the inside. Its ideological core is disappearing, leaving only the shell, which means it's very, very fragile. And any shock can shatter it. And when that happens, then everything that is alternative can rush in. So it's important to kind of work it out. Like, how do we do this in the margins? Work it out in the margins, and then it can flood into the center. So really our work, you could say, is to help hollow out that core, to do things that disrupt the story in one way or another. The power of city repair isn't just in, you know, how many tons of CO2 it reduces. It's also in the message that it gives that public space is public, and you're the public, and you don't have to ask permission to do things. Like, you can do whatever you want. Like, that is a powerful story disruptor, especially when you can actually see it. We might say that this is a room of the people who get it, but if you're like me, you don't get it entirely. You know, all of us are living the new story in some ways and the old story in other ways. I discover that all the time, you know? Like, I'll have a realization of like, oh my God, for the last 20 years, I've been subtly trying to manipulate my children by making them feel good about themselves if they do something I like and bad about themselves. And I'm it can be really subtle, you know, I've been aware of it for a while, but like, oh, but here's another way I've been doing it, like with my tone of voice. Like, so unless you were born in a rainforest, I mean, even if you're indigenous, but like Native American, unless you were like free of modern education, free of financial pressure your whole life, unless you were born or you've gone through such a profound transformation, like, you know, a near-death experience or something like that, probably you're like me, highly and unconsciously conditioned by the story that's dominated civilization for thousands of years. And if you accomplish nothing else in your life but to step 10% out of that story and pass a little bit less little less of it on to others and to the future generations, you've lived a pretty good life. This revolution is not going to just take one generation. You know, it's a project of thousands of years. But I do believe that we are at a crucial nexus, a turning point. An initiatory moment. Climate change is an initiation. It's the second one. The second phenomenon that has arisen that is telling us what we do to the other, we do to ourselves. The first was nuclear weapons, which forever ended the era of total war. And now it's expanding to include all beings, not just human beings. The second initiation is upon us. I think I'm going to leave it at that.
You've just heard from Charles Eisenstein, author of The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. He was accompanied by musician Trevor Oswald, East Forest, and they were invited by the City Repair Project and Economic Justice Action Group to speak at the First Unitarian Church a couple of weeks ago. This has been The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. Thanks for